him. And he had a feeling that they were all gathered together in a conspiracy against him, laughing and talking behind his back. There he stood by Miss Parry's chair as though he had been cut out of wood, he talking about wildflowers. Never, never had he suffered so infernally. He must have forgotten even to pretend to listen. At last he woke up. He saw Miss Parry looking rather disturbed, rather indignant, with her prominent eyes fixed. He almost cried out that he couldn't attend because he was in hell. People began going out of the room. He heard them talking about fetching cloaks, about its being cold on the water and so on. They were going boating on the lake by moonlight, one of Sally's mad ideas. He could hear her describing the moon, and they all went out. He was left quite alone. "Don't you want to go with them?" said Aunt Helena. Old Miss Parry, she had guessed. And he turned round, and there was Clarissa again. She had come back to fetch him. He was overcome by her generosity, her goodness. "Come along," she said. "They're waiting." He had never felt so happy in the whole of his life. Without a word, they made it up. They walked down to the lake. He had 20 minutes of perfect happiness. Her voice, her laugh, her dress, something floating, white, crimson. Her spirit, her adventurousness. She made them all disembark and explore the island. She startled a hen. She laughed. She sang. And all the time, he knew perfectly well, Dalloway was falling in love with her. She was falling in love with Dalloway. But it didn't seem to matter. Nothing mattered. They sat on the ground and talked, he and Clarissa. They went in and out of each other's minds without any effort. And then, in a second, it was over. He said to himself as they were getting into the boat, "She will marry that man." Dully, without any resentment. But it was an obvious thing. Dalloway would marry Clarissa. At the office, they advanced him to a post of considerable responsibility. They were proud of him. He had won crosses. "You have done your duty. It's up to us," began Mr. Brewer. And could not finish, so pleasurable was his emotion. They took admirable lodgings off the Tottenham Court Road. Here he opened Shakespeare once more. That boy's business of the intoxication of language, Antony and Cleopatra, had shrivelled utterly. How Shakespeare loathed humanity, the putting on of clothes, the getting of children, the sordidity of the mouth and the belly. This was now revealed to Septimus, the message hidden in the beauty of words. The secret signal which one generation passes under disguise to the next is loathing, hatred, despair. Dante, the same. Aeschylus, translated, the same. There Horatia sat at the table trimming hats. She trimmed hats for Mrs. Filmer's friends. She trimmed hats by the hour. She looked pale, mysterious, like a lily drowned under water, he thought. "The English are so serious," she would say, putting her arms round Septimus, her cheek against his. Love between man and woman was repulsive to Shakespeare. The business of copulation was filth to him before the end. "But," Horatia said, "we must have children." They had been married 5 years. They went to the Tower together, to the Victoria and Albert Museum, stood in the crowd to see the King open Parliament. And there were the shops, hat shops, dress shops, shops with leather bags in the window, where she would stand staring. But she must have a boy. She must have a son like Septimus, she said. But nobody could be like Septimus, so gentle, so serious, so clever. Could she not read Shakespeare too? Was Shakespeare a difficult author? She asked. One cannot bring children into a world like this. One cannot perpetuate suffering or increase the breed of these lustful animals who have no lasting emotions but only whims and vanities, eddying them now this way, now that. He watched her snip, shape, as one watches a bird hop, flit in the grass without daring to move a finger. For the truth is, let her ignore it, that human beings have neither kindness nor faith nor charity beyond what serves to increase the pleasure of the moment. They hunt in packs. Their packs scour the desert and vanish screaming into the wilderness. They desert the fallen. They are plastered over with grimaces. There was Brewer at the office, with his waxed moustache, coral tie-pin, white slip, and pleasurable emotions, all coldness and clamminess within. His geraniums ruined in the war, his cook's nerves destroyed. Or Amelia, what's-her-name, handing round cups of tea punctually at 5. A leering, sneering, obscene little harpy. And the Toms and Berties in their starched shirt fronts, oozing thick drops of vice. They never saw him drawing pictures of them naked at their antics in his notebook. In the street, vans roared past him, brutality blared out on placards, men were trapped in mines, women burnt alive. And once, a maimed file of lunatics being exercised or displayed for the diversion of the populace, who laughed aloud, ambled and nodded and grinned past him in the Tottenham Court Road, each half apologetically, yet triumphantly, inflicting his hopeless woe. And would he go mad? "It's too small for Mrs. Peters," said Septimus. For the first time for days he was speaking as he used to do. Of course it was. Absurdly small, she said. But Mrs. Peters had chosen it. He took it out of her hands. He said it was an organ grinder's monkey's hat. How it rejoiced her, that! Not for weeks had they laughed like this together, poking fun privately like married people. What she meant was that if Mrs. Filmer had come in, or Mrs. Peters, or anybody, they would not have understood what she and Septimus were laughing at. "There," she said, pinning a rose to one side of the hat. Never had she felt so happy, never in her life. But that was still more ridiculous, Septimus said. Now the poor woman looked like a pig at a fair. Nobody ever made her laugh as Septimus did. What had she got in her workbox? She had ribbons and beads, tassels, artificial flowers. She tumbled them out on the table. He began putting odd colours together, for though he had no fingers, couldn't even do up a parcel, he had a wonderful eye, and often he was right, sometimes absurd, of course, but sometimes wonderfully right. "She shall have a beautiful hat," he murmured, taking up this and that, Razia kneeling by his side, looking over his shoulder. Now it was finished, that is to say, the design. She must stitch it together, but she must be very, very careful, he said, to keep it just as he made it. So she sewed. When she sewed, he thought, she made a sound like a kettle on the hob, bubbling, murmuring, always busy, her strong little pointed fingers pinching and poking, her needle flashing straight. The sun might go in and out, on the tassels, on the wallpaper. But he would wait, he thought, stretching out his feet, looking at his ringed sock at the end of the sofa. He would wait in this warm place, this pocket of still air, which one comes on at the edge of a wood sometimes in the evening, when, because of a fall in the ground or some arrangement of the trees, one must be scientific above all, scientific, warmth lingers, and the air buffets the cheek like the wing of a bird. "There it is," said Razia, twirling Mrs. Peters' hat on the tips of her fingers. "That'll do for the moment. Later—" Her sentence bubbled away, drip, 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 like a contented tap left running. It was wonderful. Never had he done anything which made him feel so proud. It was so real, it was so substantial, Mrs. Peters' hat. "Just look at it," he said. Yes, it would always make her happy to see that hat. He had become himself then. He had laughed then. They had been alone together. Always she would like that hat. He told her to try it on. "But I must look so queer," she cried, running over to the glass and looking first this side, then that. Then she snatched it off again, for there was a tap at the door. Could it be Sir William Bradshaw? Had he sent already? No, it was only the small girl with the evening paper. Gently, the yellow curtain with all the birds of paradise blew out, and it seemed as if there were a flight of wings into the room, right out, then sucked back, for the windows were open. Was it draughty? Ellie Henderson wondered. She was subject to chills. But it didn't matter that she should come down sneezing tomorrow. It was the girls with their naked shoulders she thought of, being trained to think of others by an old father, an invalid, late vicar of Boughton. But he was dead now, and her chills never went to her chest, never. It was the girls she thought of, the young girls with their bare shoulders, she herself having always been a wisp of a creature, with her thin hair and meagre profile, though now, past 50, there was beginning to shine through some mild beam, something purified into distinction by years of self-abnegation, but obscured again, perpetually, by her distressing gentility, her panic fear, which arose from £300 income, and her weaponless state. She couldn't earn a penny, and it made her timid, and more disqualified, year by year, to meet well-dressed people who did this sort of thing every night of the season, merely telling their maids, "I'll wear so-and-so," whereas Ellie Henderson ran out nervously and bought cheap pink flowers, half a dozen, and then threw a shawl over her old black dress. For her invitation to Clarissa's party had come at the last moment. She was not quite happy about it. She had a sort of feeling that Clarissa had not meant to ask her this year. Why should she? There was no reason, really, except that they had always known each other. Indeed, they were cousins. But naturally they had rather drifted apart, Clarissa being so sought after. It was an event to her, going to a party. It was quite a treat just to see the lovely clothes. Wasn't that Elizabeth? Grown up, with her hair done in the fashionable way, in the pink dress. Yet she couldn't be more than 17. She was very, very handsome. But girls, when they first came out, didn't seem to wear white as they used. She must remember everything to tell Edith. Girls wore straight frocks, perfectly tight, with skirts well above the ankles. It was not becoming, she thought. So, with her weak eyesight, Ellie Henderson craned rather forward, and it wasn't so much she who minded not having anyone to talk to. She hardly knew anybody there, for she felt they were all such interesting people to watch, politicians, presumably, Richard Dalloway's friends. But it was Richard himself who felt that he could not let the poor creature go on standing there all the evening by herself. "Well, Ellie, and how's the world treating you?" he said in his genial way. And Ellie Henderson, getting nervous and flushing and feeling that it was extraordinarily nice of him to come and talk to her, said that many people really felt the heat more than the cold. "Yes, they do," said Richard Dalloway. "Yes." But what more did one say? "Hello, Richard," said somebody, taking him by the elbow, and, "Good Lord, there was old Peter Walsh. He was delighted to see him, ever so pleased to see him. He hadn't changed a bit." And off they went together, walking right across the room, giving each other little pats, as if they hadn't met for a long time, Ellie Henderson thought, watching them go. Certain she knew that man's face. A tall man, middle-aged, rather fine eyes, dark, wearing spectacles, with a look of John Burroughs, Edith would be sure to know. She could remember scene after scene at Boughton. Peter furious. Hugh not, of course, his match in any way, but still not a positive imbecile, as Peter made out, not a mere barber's block. When his old mother wanted him to give up shooting or to take her to Bath, he did it, without a word. He was really unselfish. And as for saying, as Peter did, that he had no heart, no brain, nothing but the manners and breeding of an English gentleman, that was only her dear Peter at his worst. And he could be intolerable. He could be impossible. But adorable to walk with on a morning like this. June had drawn out every leaf on the trees. The mothers of Pimlico gave suck to their young. Messages were passing from the fleet to the Admiralty. Arlington Street and Piccadilly seemed to chafe the very air in the park and lift its leaves hotly, brilliantly, on waves of that divine vitality which Clarissa loved. To dance, to ride, she had adored all that. For they might be parted for hundreds of years, she and Peter. She never wrote a letter, and his were dry sticks. But suddenly it would come over her. If he were with me now, what would he say? Some days, some sights bringing him back to her calmly, without the old bitterness, which perhaps was the reward of having cared for people. They came back in the middle of St. James's Park on a fine morning. Indeed, they did. But Peter, however beautiful the day might be, and the trees and the grass and the little girl in pink, Peter never saw a thing of all that. He would put on his spectacles if she told him to. He would look. It was the state of the world that interested him. Wagner, Pope's poetry, people's characters eternally, and the defects of her own soul. How he scolded her. How they argued. She would marry a prime minister and stand at the top of a staircase. The perfect hostess, he called her. She had cried over it in her bedroom. She had the makings of the perfect hostess, he said. So she would still find herself arguing in St. James's Park, still making out that she had been right, and she had, too, not to marry him. For in marriage, a little license, a little independence, there must be between people living together day in, day out in the same house, which Richard gave her, and she him. Where was he this morning, for instance? Some committee, she never asked what. But with Peter, everything had to be shared, everything gone into. And it was intolerable. And when it came to that scene in the little garden by the fountain, she had to break with him, or they would have been destroyed, both of them ruined, she was convinced. Though she had borne about with her for years, like an arrow sticking in her heart, the grief, the anguish. And then the horror of the moment when someone told her at a concert that he had married a woman met on the boat going to India. Never should she forget all that. Cold, heartless, a prude, he called her. Never could she understand how he cared. But those Indian women did, presumably. Silly, pretty, flimsy nincompoops. And she wasted her pity. For he was quite happy, he assured her, perfectly happy, though he had never done a thing that they talked of. His whole life had been a failure. It made her angry still. No, the words meant absolutely nothing to her now. She couldn't even get an echo of her old emotion. But she could remember going cold with excitement and doing her hair in a kind of ecstasy. Now the old feeling began to come back to her as she took out her hairpins, laid them on the dressing table, began to do her hair. With the rooks flaunting up and down in the pink evening light, and dressing, and going downstairs, and feeling as she crossed the hall, if it were now to die, 'twere now to be most happy. That was her feeling, Othello's feeling, and she felt it, she was convinced, as strongly as Shakespeare meant Othello to feel it. All because she was coming down to dinner in a white frock to meet Sally Seton. She was wearing pink gauze. Was that possible? She seemed, anyhow, all light, glowing, like some bird or air ball that has flown in, attached itself for a moment to a bramble. But nothing is so strange when one is in love, and what was this except being in love, as the complete indifference of other people. Aunt Helena just wandered off after dinner. Papa read the paper. Peter Walsh might have been there, and old Miss Cummings. Joseph Breitkopf certainly was, for he came every summer, poor old man, for weeks and weeks, and pretended to read German with her, but really played the piano and sang Brahms without any voice. All this was only a background for Sally. She stood by the fireplace, talking in that beautiful voice which made everything she said sound like a caress, to Papa, who had begun to be attracted rather against his will. He never got over lending her one of his books and finding it soaked on the terrace, when suddenly she said, "What a shame to sit indoors!" And they all went out onto the terrace and walked up and down. Peter Walsh and Joseph Breitkopf went on about Wagner. She and Sally fell a little behind. Then came the most exquisite moment of her whole life, passing a stone urn with flowers in it. Sally stopped, picked a flower, kissed her on the lips. The whole world might have turned upside down. The others disappeared. There she was, alone with Sally, and she felt that she had been given a present, wrapped up, and told just to keep it, not to look at it. A diamond, something infinitely precious, wrapped up, which, as they walked, up and down, she uncovered, or the radiance burnt through, the revelation, the religious feeling, when old Joseph and Peter faced them. "Stargazing," said Peter. It was like running one's face against a granite wall in the darkness. It was shocking. It was horrible. Not for herself. She felt only how Sally was being mauled already, maltreated. She felt his hostility, his jealousy, his determination to break into their companionship. All this she saw as one sees a landscape in a flash of lightning. And Sally, never had she admired her so much, gallantly taking her way unvanquished. She laughed. She made old Joseph tell her the names of the stars, which she liked doing very seriously. She stood there. She listened. She heard the names of the stars. "Oh, this horror," she said to herself, as if she had known all along that something would interrupt, would embitter her moment of happiness. Dalloway rode them in. He said nothing. But somehow, as they watched him start, jumping onto his bicycle to ride 20 miles through the woods, wobbling off down the drive, waving his hand and disappearing, he obviously did feel, instinctively, tremendously, strongly, all that, the night, the romance, Clarissa. He deserved to have her. For himself, he was absurd. His demands upon Clarissa, he could see it now, were absurd. He asked impossible things. He made terrible scenes. She would have accepted him still, perhaps, if he had been less absurd. Sally thought so. She wrote him all that summer long letters, how they had talked of him, how she had praised him, how Clarissa burst into tears. It was an extraordinary summer, all letters, scenes, telegrams, arriving at Boughton early in the morning, hanging about till the servants were up, appalling tete-a-tetes with old Mr. Parry at breakfast, Aunt Helena formidable but kind, Sally sweeping him off for talks in the vegetable garden, Clarissa in bed with headaches. The final scene, the terrible scene which he believed had mattered more than anything in the whole of his life, it might be an exaggeration, but still, so it did seem now, happened at 3 o'clock in the afternoon of a very hot day. It was a trifle that led up to it. Sally at lunch saying something about Dalloway, and calling him, "My name is Dalloway," whereupon Clarissa suddenly stiffened, coloured in a way she had, and rapped out sharply, "We've had enough of that feeble joke." That was all. But for him, it was precisely as if she had said, "I'm only amusing myself with you. I've an understanding with Richard Dalloway." So he took it. He had not slept for nights. "It's got to be finished one way or the other," he said to himself. He sent a note to her by Sally, asking her to meet him by the fountain at 3. "Something very important has happened," he scribbled at the end of it. The fountain was in the middle of a little shrubbery, far from the house, with shrubs and trees all round it. There she came, even before the time, and they stood with the fountain between them, the spout, it was broken, dribbling water incessantly. How sights fix themselves upon the mind. For example, the vivid green moss. She didn't move. "Tell me the truth, tell me the truth," he kept on saying. He felt as if his forehead would burst. She seemed contracted, petrified. She didn't move. "Tell me the truth," he repeated, when suddenly that old man, Breitkopf, popped his head in carrying the Times, stared at them, gaped, and went away. They neither of them moved. "Tell me the truth," he repeated. He felt that he was grinding against something physically hard. She was unyielding. She was like iron, like flint, rigid up the backbone. And when she said, "It's no use, it's no use, this is the end," after he had spoken for hours, it seemed, with the tears running down his cheeks, it was as if she had hit him in the face. She turned, she left him, went away. "Clarissa!" he cried. "Clarissa!" But she never came back. It was over. He went away that night. He never saw her again. At tea, Rezia told him that Mrs. Filmer's daughter was expecting a baby. She could not grow old and have no children. She was very lonely. She was very unhappy. She cried for the first time since they were married. Far away he heard her sobbing. He heard it accurately. He noticed it distinctly. He compared it to a piston thumping. But he felt nothing. His wife was crying, and he felt nothing. Only each time she sobbed in this profound, this silent, this hopeless way, he descended another step into the pit. At last, with a melodramatic gesture which he assumed mechanically and with complete consciousness of its insincerity, he dropped his head on his hands. Now he had surrendered. Now other people must help him. People must be sent for. He gave in. Nothing could rouse him. Rezia put him to bed. She sent for a doctor, Mrs. Filmer's Dr. Holmes. Dr. Holmes examined him. "There was nothing whatever the matter," said Dr. Holmes. Oh, what a relief! What a kind man! What a good man, thought Rezia. "When he felt like that, he went to the music hall," said Dr. Holmes. "He took a day off with his wife and played golf. Why not try 2 tabloids of bromide dissolved in a glass of water at bedtime?" "These old Bloomsbury houses," said Dr. Holmes, tapping the wall, "are often full of very fine panelling, which the landlords have the folly to paper over. Only the other day, visiting a patient, Sir Somebody Something, in Bedford Square." So there was no excuse. Nothing whatever the matter, except the sin for which human nature had condemned him to death, that he did not feel. He hadn't cared when Evans was killed. That was worst. But all the other crimes raised their heads and shook their fingers and jeered and sneered over the rail of the bed in the early hours of the morning at the prostrate body which lay realizing its degradation. How he had married his wife without loving her, had lied to her, seduced her, outraged Miss Isabel Pole, and were so pocked and marked with vice that women shuddered when they saw him in the street. The verdict of human nature on such a wretch was death. Dr. Holmes came again, large, fresh-coloured, handsome, flicking his boots, looking in the glass. He brushed it all aside. Headaches, sleeplessness, fears, dreams, nerve symptoms, and nothing more, he said. If Dr. Holmes found himself even half a pound below 11 stone 6, he asked his wife for another plate of porridge at breakfast. Rizzio would learn to cook porridge. But, he continued, health is largely a matter in our own control. Throw yourself into outside interests. Take up some hobby. He opened Shakespeare, Antony and Cleopatra, pushed Shakespeare aside. Some hobby, said Dr. Holmes, for did he not owe his own excellent health, and he worked as hard as any man in London, to the fact that he could always switch off from his patients onto old furniture. And what a very pretty comb, if he might say so, Mrs. Warren Smith was wearing. What always happened then happened. What happened every night of their lives. The small girl sucked her thumb at the door. Rizzio went down on her knees. Rizzio cooed and kissed. Rizzio got a bag of sweets out of the table drawer. For so it always happened. First one thing, then another. So she built it up, first one thing and then another. Dancing, skipping, round and round the room they went. He took the paper. Surrey was all out, he read. There was a heat wave. Rizzio repeated, Surrey was all out. There was a heat wave, making it part of the game she was playing with Mrs. Filmer's grandchild, both of them laughing, chattering at the same time, at their game. He was very tired. He was very happy. He would sleep. He shut his eyes. But directly he saw nothing, the sounds of the game became fainter and stranger and sounded like the cries of people seeking and not finding and passing further and further away. They had lost him. He started up in terror. What did he see? The plate of bananas on the sideboard. Nobody was there. Rizzio had taken the child to its mother. It was bedtime. That was it. To be alone forever. That was the doom pronounced in Milan when he came into the room and saw them cutting out buckram shapes with their scissors. To be alone forever. He was alone with the sideboard and the bananas. He was alone, exposed on this bleak eminence, stretched out. But not on a hilltop, not on a crag, on Mrs. Filmer's sitting-room sofa. As for the visions, the faces, the voices of the dead, where were they? There was a screen in front of him, with black bulrushes and blue swallows. Where he had once seen mountains, where he had seen faces, where he had seen beauty, there was a screen. Evans! He cried. There was no answer. A mouse had squeaked, or a curtain rustled. Those were the voices of the dead. The screen, the coal scuttle, the sideboard remained to him. Let him then face the screen, the coal scuttle, and the sideboard. But Rizzio burst into the room chattering. Some letter had come. Everybody's plans were changed. Mrs. Filmer would not be able to go to Brighton after all. There was no time to let Mrs. Williams know, and really Rizzio thought it very, very annoying when she caught sight of the hat and thought, perhaps she might just make a little... Her voice died out in contented melody. Ah, damn, she cried. It was a joke of theirs, her swearing. The needle had broken. Hat, child, Brighton, needle. She built it up. First one thing, then another. She built it up, sewing. She wanted him to say whether by moving the rose she had improved the hat. She sat on the end of the sofa. They were perfectly happy now, she said suddenly, putting the hat down. For she could say anything to him now. She could say whatever came into her head. That was almost the first thing she had felt about him, that night in the café when he had come in with his English friends. He had come in, rather shyly, looking round him, and his hat had fallen where he hung it up. That she could remember. She knew he was English, though not one of the large Englishmen her sister admired, for he was always thin. But he had a beautiful fresh colour, and with his big nose, his bright eyes, his way of sitting a little hunched, made her think, she had often told him, of a young hawk, that first evening she saw him, when they were playing dominoes, and he had come in, of a young hawk. But with her he was always very gentle. She had never seen him wild or drunk, only suffering sometimes through this terrible war, but even so, when she came in, he would put it all away. Anything, anything in the whole world, any little bother with her work, anything that struck her to say, she would tell him, and he understood at once. Her own family even were not the same. Being older than she was, and being so clever, how serious he was, wanting her to read Shakespeare before she could even read a child's story in English. Being so much more experienced, he could help her. And she, too, could help him. The curtain, with its flight of birds of paradise, blew out again. And Clarissa saw... She saw Ralph Lyon beat it back and go on talking. So it wasn't a failure after all. It was going to be all right now, her party. It had begun. It had started. But it was still touch and go. She must stand there for the present. People seemed to come in a rush. Colonel and Mrs. Garrard, Mr. Hugh Whitbread, Mr. Bowley, Mrs. Hilbury, Lady Mary Maddox, Mr. Quinn, intoned Wilkin. She had six or seven words with each, and they went on. They went into the rooms, into something now, not nothing, since Ralph Lyon had beat back the curtain. And yet, for her own part, it was too much of an effort. She was not enjoying it. It was too much like being just anybody standing there. Anybody could do it. Yet this anybody she did a little admire, couldn't help feeling that she had, anyhow, made this happen, that it marked a stage, this post that she felt herself to have become, for oddly enough, she had quite forgotten what she looked like, but felt herself a stake driven in at the top of her stairs. Every time she gave a party, she had this feeling of being something not herself, and that everyone was unreal in one way, much more real in another. It was, she thought, partly their clothes, partly being taken out of their ordinary ways, partly the background. It was possible to say things you couldn't say anyhow else, things that needed an effort, possible to go much deeper. But not for her. Not yet, anyhow. "How delightful to see you," she said. "Dear old Sir Harry, he would know everyone." And what was so odd about it was the sense one had as they came up the stairs one after another, Mrs. Mount and Celia, Herbert Ainstey, Mrs. Dacres. Oh, and Lady Bruton! "How awfully good of you to come," she said, and she meant it. It was odd how standing there one felt them going on, some quite old, some... What name? Lady Rossiter? But who on earth was Lady Rossiter? Clarissa! That voice. It was Sally Seton. Sally Seton, after all these years. She loomed through a mist, for she hadn't looked like that, Sally Seton, when Clarissa grasped the hot water can to think of her under this roof. Not like that. All on top of each other, embarrassed, laughing, words tumbled out. "Passing through London, heard from Clara Hayden. What a chance of seeing you! So I thrust myself in, without an invitation." One might put down the hot water can quite composedly. The lustre had gone out of her. Yet it was extraordinary to see her again. Older, happier, less lovely. They kissed each other, first this cheek, then that, by the drawing-room door, and Clarissa turned, with Sally's hand in hers, and saw her rooms full, heard the roar of voices, saw the candlesticks, the blowing curtains, and the roses which Richard had given her. "I have 5 enormous boys," said Sally. She had the simplest egotism, the most open desire to be thought first always, and Clarissa loved her for being still like that. "I can't believe it," she cried, kindling all over with pleasure at the thought of the past. But alas, Wilkins wanted her. Wilkins was emitting in a voice of commanding authority, as if the whole company must be admonished and the hostess reclaimed from frivolity, one name. "The Prime Minister," said Peter Walsh. "The Prime Minister? Was it really?" Ellie Henderson marvelled. "What a thing to tell Edith!" She had reached the park gates. She stood for a moment, looking at the omnibuses in Piccadilly. She would not say of anyone in the world now that they were this or were that. She felt very young, at the same time unspeakably aged. She sliced like a knife through everything, at the same time was outside, looking on. She had a perpetual sense, as she watched the taxicabs, of being out, out, far out to sea and alone. She always had the feeling that it was very, very dangerous to live even one day. Not that she thought herself clever or much out of the ordinary. How she had got through life on the few twigs of knowledge Fräulein Daniels gave them, she couldn't think. She knew nothing. No language, no history. She scarcely read a book now, except memoirs in bed. And yet to her it was absolutely absorbing, all this. The cabs passing. And she would not say of Peter, she would not say of herself, "I am this, I am that." Her only gift was knowing people almost by instinct, she thought, walking on. If you put her in a room with someone, up went her back like a cat's, or she purred. Devonshire House, Bath House, the house with the china cockatoo, she'd seen them all lit up once. And remembered Sylvia, Fred, Sally Seaton, such hosts of people, and dancing all night, and the wagons plodding past to market, and driving home across the park. She remembered once throwing a shilling into the Serpentine. But everyone remembered. What she loved was this, here, now, in front of her, the fat lady in the cab. Did it matter, then, she asked herself, walking towards Bond Street, did it matter that she must inevitably cease completely? All this must go on without her? Did she resent it? Or did it not become consoling to believe that death ended absolutely, but that somehow, in the streets of London, on the ebb and flow of things, here, there, she survived? Peter survived, lived in each other, she being part, she was positive, of the trees at home, of the house there, ugly, rambling all to bits and pieces as it was. Part of people she had never met, being laid out like a mist between the people she knew best, who lifted her on their branches as she had seen the trees lift the mist. But it spread ever so far, her life, herself. What was she dreaming as she looked into Hatchard's shop window? What was she trying to recover? What image of white dawn in the country? As she read in the book spread open, "Fear no more the heat of the sun, nor the furious winter's rages." Yet, after all, how much she owed to him later. Always when she thought of him, she thought of their quarrels for some reason, because she wanted his good opinion so much, perhaps. She owed him words, sentimental, civilised. They started up every day of her life as if he guarded her. A book was sentimental, an attitude to life sentimental. Sentimental, perhaps, she was, to be thinking of the past. What would he think, she wondered, when he came back? That she had grown older? Would he say that? Or would she see him thinking when he came back that she had grown older? It was true. Since her illness, she had turned almost white. Laying her brooch on the table, she had a sudden spasm, as if, while she mused, the icy claws had had the chance to fix in her. She was not old yet. She had just broken into her 52nd year. Months and months of it were still untouched. June, July, August, each still remained almost whole, and as if to catch the falling drop, Clarissa, crossing to the dressing table, plunged into the very heart of the moment, transfixed it. There. The moment of this June morning on which was the pressure of all the other mornings, seeing the glass, the dressing table, and all the bottles afresh, collecting the whole of her at one point as she looked into the glass, seeing the delicate pink face of the woman who was that very night to give a party, of Clarissa Dalloway, of herself. How many million times she had seen her face, and always with the same imperceptible contraction. She pursed her lips when she looked in the glass. It was to give her face point. That was herself, pointed, dart-like, definite. That was herself, when some effort, some call on her to be herself, drew the parts together. She alone knew how different, how incompatible and composed so for the world only, into one centre, one diamond, one woman who sat in her drawing-room and made a meeting-point, a radiancy, no doubt, in some dull lives, a refuge for the lonely to come to, perhaps. She had helped young people who were grateful to her, had tried to be the same always, never showing a sign of all the other sides of her, faults, jealousies, vanities, suspicions, like this of Lady Bruton not asking her to lunch. Which, she thought, combing her hair finally, is utterly base. Now, where was her dress? It was awful, he cried. Awful, awful. Still, the sun was hot. Still, one got over things. Still, life had a way of adding day to day. Still, he thought, yawning and beginning to take notice. Regent's Park had changed very little since he was a boy, except for the squirrels. Still, presumably there were compensations. When little Elise Mitchell, who had been picking up pebbles to add to the pebble collection which she and her brother were making on the nursery mantelpiece, plumped her handful down on the nurse's knee and scudded off again full tilt into a lady's legs, Peter Walsh laughed out. But Lucrezia Warren Smith was saying to herself, "It's wicked. Why should I suffer?" she was asking as she walked down the broad path. "No, I can't stand it any longer," she was saying, having left Septimus, who wasn't Septimus any longer, to say hard, cruel, wicked things, to talk to himself, to talk to a dead man on the seat over there. When the child ran full tilt into her, fell flat, and burst out crying. That was comforting, rather. She stood her upright, dusted her frock, kissed her. But for herself she had done nothing wrong. She had loved Septimus. She had been happy. She had had a beautiful home, and there her sisters lived still, making hats. Why should she suffer? The child ran straight back to its nurse, and Rezia saw her scolded, comforted, taken up by the nurse, who put down her knitting, and the kind-looking man gave her his watch to blow open to comfort her. But why should she be exposed? Why not left in Milan? Why tortured? Why? Slightly waved by tears, the broad path, the nurse, the man in grey, the perambulator, rose and fell before her eyes. To be rocked by this malignant torturer was her lot. But why? She was like a bird sheltering under the thin hollow of a leaf, who blinks at the sun when the leaf moves, starts at the crack of a dry twig. She was exposed. She was surrounded by the enormous trees, vast clouds of an indifferent world. Exposed. Tortured. And why should she suffer? Why? She frowned. She stamped her foot. She must go back again to Septimus, since it was almost time for them to be going to Sir William Bradshaw. She must go back and tell him. Go back to him sitting there on the green chair under the tree, talking to himself, or to that dead man Evans, whom she had only seen once for a moment in the shop. He had seemed a nice, quiet man, a great friend of Septimus's, and he had been killed in the war. But such things happen to everyone. Everyone has friends who were killed in the war. Everyone gives up something when they marry. She had given up her home. She had come to live here, in this awful city. But Septimus let himself think about horrible things, as she could too if she tried. He had grown stranger and stranger. He said people were talking behind the bedroom walls. Mrs. Filmer thought it odd. He saw things, too. He had seen an old woman's head in the middle of a fern. Yet he could be happy when he chose. They went to Hampton Court on top of a bus, and they were perfectly happy. All the little red and yellow flowers were out on the grass, like floating lamps, he said, and talked and chattered and laughed, making up stories. Suddenly he said, "Now we will kill ourselves," when they were standing by the river. And he looked at it with a look which she had seen in his eyes when a train went by, or an omnibus, a look as if something fascinated him. And she felt he was going from her, and she caught him by the arm. But going home, he was perfectly quiet, perfectly reasonable. He would argue with her about killing themselves, and explain how wicked people were, how he could see them making up lies as they passed in the street. He knew all their thoughts, he said. He knew everything. He knew the meaning of the world, he said. Then when they got back, he could hardly walk. He lay on the sofa and made her hold his hand to prevent him from falling down. Down, he cried, into the flames. And saw faces laughing at him, calling him horrible, disgusting names from the walls, and hands pointing round the screen. Yet they were quite alone. But he began to talk aloud, answering people, arguing, laughing, crying, getting very excited and making her write things down. Perfect nonsense it was, about death, about Miss Isabel Pole. She could stand it no longer. She would go back. When the damned fool came again, Septimus refused to see him. "Did he indeed?" said Dr. Holmes, smiling agreeably. Really, he had to give that charming little lady, Mrs. Smith, a friendly push before he could get past her into her husband's bedroom. "So you're in a funk," he said agreeably, sitting down by his patient's side. He had actually talked of killing himself to his wife. Quite a girl, a foreigner, wasn't she? Didn't that give her a very odd idea of English husbands? Didn't one owe, perhaps, a duty to one's wife? Wouldn't it be better to do something instead of lying in bed? For he had had 40 years' experience behind him, and Septimus could take Dr. Holmes's word for it. There was nothing whatever the matter with him. And next time Dr. Holmes came, he hoped to find Smith out of bed and not making that charming little lady, his wife, anxious about him. Human nature, in short, was on him. The repulsive brute with the blood-red nostrils. Holmes was on him. Dr. Holmes came quite regularly every day. "Once you stumble," Septimus wrote on the back of a postcard, "human nature is on you. Holmes is on you." Their only chance was to escape without letting Holmes know. To Italy. Anywhere. Anywhere. Away from Dr. Holmes. But Rezia couldn't understand him. Dr. Holmes was such a kind man. He was so interested in Septimus. He only wanted to help them, he said. He had 4 little children, and he had asked her to tea, she told Septimus. So he was deserted. The whole world was clamouring, kill yourself, for our sakes. But why should he kill himself for their sakes? Food was pleasant, the sun hot. And this killing oneself, how does one set about it? With a table knife, uglily, with floods of blood? By sucking a gas pipe? He was too weak, he could scarcely raise his hand. Besides, now that he was quite alone, condemned, deserted, as those who are about to die are alone, there was a luxury in it, an isolation full of sublimity, a freedom which the attached can never know. Holmes had won, of course. The brute with the red nostrils had won. But even Holmes himself couldn't touch this last relic straying on the edge of the world, this outcast who gazed back at the inhabited regions, who lay like a drowned sailor on the shore of the world. But this hat now. And then it was getting late. Sir William Bradshaw. She held her hands to her head, waiting for him to say did he like the hat or not. And as she sat there, waiting, looking down, he could feel her mind, like a bird, falling from branch to branch, and always alighting quite rightly. He could follow her mind as she sat there in one of those loose, lax poses that came to her naturally, and, if he should say anything, at once she smiled, like a bird alighting with all its claws firm upon the bough. But he remembered Bradshaw said, "The people we are most fond of are not good for us when we are ill." Bradshaw said he must be taught to rest. Bradshaw said they must be separated. Must, must, why must? What power had Bradshaw over him? What right has Bradshaw to say must to me? He demanded. "It is because you talked of killing yourself," said Rezia. Mercifully, she could now say anything to Septimus. So he was in their power. Holmes and Bradshaw were on him. The brute with the red nostrils was snuffing into every secret place. Must, it could say. Where were his papers, the things he had written? She brought him his papers, the things he had written, things she had written for him. She tumbled them out onto the sofa. They looked at them together. Diagrams, designs, little men and women brandishing sticks for arms, with wings, were they, on their backs. Circles traced round shillings and sixpences. The suns and stars. Zigzagging precipices with mountaineers ascending, roped together, exactly like knives and forks. Sea pieces with little faces laughing out of what might perhaps be waves. The map of the world. "Burn them," he cried. Now for his writings. How the dead sing behind rhododendron bushes, odes to time, conversations with Shakespeare. Evans, 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 his messages from the dead. Do not cut down trees, tell the Prime Minister. Universal love, the meaning of the world. Burn them, he cried. But Rezia laid her hands on them. Some were very beautiful, she thought. She would tie them up, for she had no envelope, with a piece of silk. Even if they took him, she said, she would go with him. They could not separate them against their wills, she said. One couldn't laugh at him. He looked so ordinary. You might have stood him behind a counter and bought biscuits. Poor chap, all rigged up in gold lace. And to be fair, as he went his rounds, first with Clarissa, then with Richard escorting him, he did it very well. He tried to look somebody. It was amusing to watch. Nobody looked at him. They just went on talking. Yet it was perfectly plain that they all knew, felt to the marrow of their bones, this majesty passing, this symbol of what they all stood for, English society. Old Lady Bruton, and she looked very fine, too, very stalwart in her lace, swam up, and they withdrew into a little room which at once became spied upon, guarded, and a sort of stir and rustle rippled through everyone, openly. The Prime Minister! Lord, Lord, the snobbery of the English, thought Peter Walsh, standing in the corner. How they love dressing up in gold lace and doing homage. There, that must be, by Jove, it was, Hugh Whitbread, snuffing round the precincts of the great, grown